Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Isabel Hardman. So today Theresa May has learnt for a second time why perhaps dining with Juncker isn't the best option. She ate with the President of the European Commission last week ahead of the big Brexit summit. And today there's a not so flattering account that's made its way to the German press. Can you tell us a bit more about that, James?
It says that she was begging, that she was desperate, that she has bags under her eyes that suggest she's very down in the dumps, and that while as when she used to laugh, her whole body erupted with the joy of laughter, she now looks like she's making a real effort to force out the laugh. So, look, it is an unflattering account. Nick Timothy, the Prime Minister's former chief of staff, immediately leapt onto Twitter to accuse Jean-Claude Juncker's chief of staff, Martin Selmayr, of having leaked it. Then, to my surprise, Martin Selmayr took to Twitter to say that he hadn't leaked it and suggest that somebody else was trying to undermine the May-Juncker relationship. Now, I find it hard to believe that those Tories who would like Theresa May to walk away from the Brexit negotiations have extensive contacts in the German press that they could use to try and place an article there, which then leads you to the alternative explanation that the national governments are trying to undermine the relationship between May and the Commission. But again, that strikes me as unlikely, in that the thing that Angela Merkel seems very keen to avoid being drawn in is being drawn into being the referee in this dispute between Britain and the EU27. Now, I would say this from my own personal journalistic experience. When people often think a leak must be somebody, and it's not that person. I remember someone once was blocked from taking a job because it was assumed that they were the source of a story I'd written. It wasn't actually them, it was somebody else. And it's also worth remembering that lots of leaks are unintentional. There are sometimes the journalists you get a dump. Someone calls you up and they want to tell you something to get it out there. Other times, someone will just end up telling you something because it's quite a funny story, and they often themselves don't realise, or they're trying to illustrate a point, and they don't realise quite how good the information they are giving you is. But I don't think it's going to do much for the trust levels between the two sides in this negotiation. But I also think that it's not going to escalate like it did last time. Last time, because of the election campaign, you had Theresa May striding into Downing Street and announcing that, you know, people in Brussels were trying to interfere in the British democratic process and that she wouldn't put up with this. I don't think you'll see that this time round. I also think the account in the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung is it's a Sunday edition. I'm not even going to try and say that in German. I think the difference is that the UK negotiating strategy was, UK government sources were quite explicit that Theresa May basically said to the Europeans, I've moved, you've got to move now, which is what it's essentially all this account says that she did.
I mean, one of the reasons I think the British side are particularly annoyed by this leak, though, is because it's the same paper that had details last time after Juncker had dinner. And also, it's again very unflattering towards the Prime Minister. I mean, Isabel, we saw at the end of the EU Council meeting last week that although Theresa May hadn't got exactly where she wanted, we're not talking about trade yet, it did really seem like the mood music had changed. Everyone was speaking a lot more positively, and it seemed like progress was being made. Do you think this is setting anyone back, or is this just the European Commission going off on one?
Well, I really agree with James on the unintentional leaking point, and you sort of wonder whether actually this is something that has come from Juncker himself, in that he may just be quite good at gossiping with friends who don't turn out to be quite as discreet as he thinks they are, potentially. But that report, and certainly, as you say, the mood music at the end of the summit, also showed that European leaders are starting to see that they need to give Britain something because of Theresa May's own difficult position, because otherwise they're going to get nothing. And the summit did show that they were being more conciliatory, although it still wasn't exactly sort of the ideal summit for her. At the end of it, Emmanuel Macron denied that she'd mentioned no deal to him. And there is still a sense that that leaders are trying to show Britain up for being bad at negotiating. That's very much the narrative that a lot of the negotiators are trying to craft, and are doing so very successfully because the government is in disarray at home as well as on Brexit.
And we'll hear later on today what Theresa May has to say when she addresses the House on that meeting. But moving to domestic issues, and the government have plenty of problems here too. One of the big things at the weekend was housing, and Sajid Javid appeared on the Andrew Marr show, but he suggested that what the government, and particularly Philip Hammer, needs to do in the budget is borrow in order to build. James, doesn't this undermine the Conservatives' economic argument? We've been told that we shouldn't borrow for years.
I think you are right about the previous Conservative economic argument, but seeing as the Tories have essentially de-weaponised deficit reduction as a political issue, you know, they hardly mentioned it in the last general election campaign, and because they're not promising to balance the books within this parliament, I don't see what I think that politically they're getting very little out of their commitment to deficit reduction right now, and borrowing to invest rather than borrowing to fund day-to-day spending is very different. And I also think on housing, you need dramatic action. You cannot say that the housing market is broken and then think that the market is going to provide a solution to this problem. And it is going to require greater state involvement because the market is broken. Now, the two things of greater state involvement I'd be very keen to see is, one is a short-term fix, which is to get the government borrowing money to build houses, to get enough houses onto the market to kickstart the process. The second thing I'd like the government to do is a structural reform to massively ease the planning laws to make it far easier to build houses, and that in the medium to long term is one of the things that will go a long way towards fixing the UK's very broken housing market.
What's really interesting is that Sajid Javid has been making this case for more house building, for more borrowing, to fund more house building in public in a way that could actually be seen as quite confrontational towards both the Treasury and the Prime Minister. It's long been known that Javid has been unhappy with the lack of radicalism in Theresa May's government. But now he's basically saying publicly, this is what you need to do in order to be radical. And he seems to be doing it with a great deal of confidence. Actually, he's not very well liked by those around Theresa May. They think that they've recognised his frustration, and some people in Number 10 actually really hate him. So he doesn't have a great deal of sort of political capital within Number 10, but that doesn't matter anymore because actually Number 10 isn't the only power base. There's Philip Hammond as well, who, James, you know more about this than I do, but he's becoming more sympathetic to Sajid Javid's arguments.
Yeah, and Javid is one of the cabinet... I mean, admittedly, this is a bit like being the tallest mountain in Holland, but he is one of the cabinet ministers who is more sympathetic to Philip Hammond. He's one of the ministers who are least in the cabinet, who are least frustrated with the Chancellor. And I think there is another case here, which is this budget... The danger, I think, for Philip Hammond is trying to go safety first, because there isn't going to be enough good news in this to go safety first. It will unravel if you try and go safety first. I think it'd be much better, you know, in cricket there's a phrase, if you're going to flash, flash hard. And he's got to flash hard here because he's got to show that he's got some momentum, that he's trying to do something. Because if he just comes up with a very plodding budget, there'll be some little measure in it, some little stealth tax somewhere or whatever, that will unravel. And because of Hammond's trouble with not only his own colleagues but the press, things will fall back in on him.
And his trouble with the press and his colleagues is partly caused by the fact that he just has the most fabulous tin ear. And we've known about this for a long time. I remember writing a piece a couple of years ago where he told Conservative MPs that there were no votes in defence. And about five of them came running to me saying, you'll never guess what Philip Hammond said. And he hasn't learnt from that yet. It's, you know, chancellors do tend to repeat their mistakes. George Osborne would lay elephant traps for the opposition that he would then fall down. Philip Hammond does things that he thinks make complete sense without any sort of regard to the politics and ends up causing a massive political row.
Now, on the subject of how hard this budget is going to be for Hammond, the Times today reports that there are some Tory MPs who want to get rid of him so much they might be willing to refuse to vote for this budget when it does arrive. Happily for Hammond, not always his biggest fan, but Jacob Rees-Mogg has taken to LBC today to say that would be unacceptable. James, can you see anyone actually doing this? I mean, it's verging on almost bringing the government down, no?
I don't think anyone's going to vote down the budget, but I think what's also true is that Hammond knows the parameters in which he is operating. When there was that story recently about tax rises for older people to fund tax cuts for young people, Hammond said to a friend, I'm not planning to do this, and even if I was planning to do this, I wouldn't have the votes to get this through. I mean, Tory backbenchers' power is in the measures that they are taking off the table preemptively before they make it into the budget box. So I think that is the case. I think what is also true is that the Rosebud's cabinet meeting on Saturday, it is amazing. Again, rather like cabinet in the old days, you know, basically people used to realise there were certain things that you could gently offer advice, but certain things you couldn't say. Because Theresa May's authority has collapsed, people are now far more frank about political strategy to her than they would be normally. And then when they're discussing the budget, I'm told that no one mentioned Hammond by name, but everyone kept saying, it's as important how you say it as what you say. It's important that we sound upbeat, positive. It's important that we don't forget how good things are overall when you look at the big picture, which was basically a plea to Philip Hammond not to sound like Eeyore again. And they're desperately trying to give him some kind of Tiggerish enthusiasm here, which won't come naturally to him, I think.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Isabel. And you can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store. It's called Coffee House Shots. And The Spectator itself from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk/podoffer.